This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 12th. This is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaks with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we'll hear from Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light. A lot to get to. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. 12 defendants since January have faced charges in alleged cases of human trafficking on Cape Cod and or the islands. The Cape and Islands District Attorney Robert Gallobois has been making the fight against human trafficking a priority. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has been reporting on this, and she joins us now with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
So this week, the DA visited the Hyannis Transit Station to talk about the latest steps his office is taking on human trafficking. You were there. Tell us more about it, and why is the Transit Authority part of this?
Well, the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority is one of a number of entities, along with police departments and others, who are working with the DA, Gallobois, to raise awareness about human trafficking. They have been participating in trainings that the DA's office organized and things like that. But the Transit Authority does have a particular role to play because transportation is often a central part of trafficking. They really didn't get into that at the DA's press conference, but national advocates and the U.S. Department of Transportation have identified the role of transportation as an issue in trafficking. Here locally, Tom Kerr, who is the administrator of the Transit Authority, said that Gallobois asked him to put up information flyers in their facilities. The DA's office has also created these new magnets with a QR code that will be placed on the RTA buses. The idea there is to give the public a way to access more information about human trafficking and, importantly, how to report tips about possible trafficking they may have observed. They might see something on a bus or at their workplace or somewhere else in the community. And this QR code will be displayed at various places to help people report suspected human trafficking.
Now, we're told that 12 people have been charged related to human trafficking in our region just since January. What do we know about these cases?
We don't have a lot of specifics about these 12 cases, but we do know what kinds of things qualify as trafficking. The primary forms are sex trafficking and forced labor, including domestic labor. And on the labor side, the national advocates say restaurants and cleaning services are some of the more common industries where people are victims of trafficking. We also know that charges are filed every year on the Cape and Islands. This is not an anomaly. When Gallobois talked about this issue publicly in February, he said that the DA's office had prosecuted 58 cases in the last 3 years, including some under the previous DA. So I think that's part of the message that he and the advocates are trying to get across, is this is happening even on the Cape and Islands, and they want to do more to prosecute the offenders, but also to help victims get out of trafficking. Because Gallobois says the typical victim tries to leave a trafficking situation 6 times before they actually make it out.
We heard some tape from one of the advocates in your reporting saying that trafficking of children happens in every community, including the Cape and Islands. Does that mean that some of the victims in this latest round of cases are children?
Again, they didn't talk about the specifics of these pending cases, but there's certainly a strong possibility that some of the victims are minors. Advocates say many cases do involve minors and the sexual exploitation of minors. Often what's happening is a trafficker is doing it for profit. And these are not necessarily situations in which the victim has been abducted off the street. You know, sometimes the trafficker is someone who is known to the victim and forces or coerces them into exploitation, and it becomes a situation the victim can't get out of. But force is not required under Massachusetts law to be guilty of trafficking, and neither is profiting from it. So there are many ways that activity can be classified as trafficking. There are other ways it happens, like through threats, for example. And young people, of course, can be more vulnerable to those kinds of things than older people at times. So, yeah.
You mentioned that trainings are happening in the community on this. What does that mean? Tell us more about that.
Sure. The DA's office organized two trainings on Cape Cod. One was focused on the service industry, including hospitality, to raise awareness and make people more aware of the services that are available with regard to trafficking. And the second one was for law enforcement officers focused on investigative techniques used in trafficking cases. Gallobois's office also organized a training on Nantucket. It was like one combined training. And all of those have already taken place. And then they are planning some additional trainings for Martha's Vineyard in September.
Okay, let's talk about the Cape Cod bridges now. Many people around the region waiting to see what happens with a more than $1 billion grant announcement that could come this summer. But in the meantime, four Republican political candidates got together this week to talk about their views on the bridge project. This is the bridge replacement, the potential replacement of the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. And these candidates were talking about why they're running. Jeanette, set the scene for us a little bit. Where was this press conference and what was happening here?
Sure. This was an outdoor press conference. Was held in the back parking lot behind the old Christmas tree shops. That location is near the foot of the Sagamore Bridge, and it has a great view of the bridge, which I'm sure is why they chose that spot. The press conference was organized by the Deaton campaign. John Deaton is a U.S. Senate candidate. He is one of three people in the Republican primary who are hoping to get the nomination to run against Senator Elizabeth Warren. He had campaign staff with him who had set up a podium, and they were filming the whole thing. And then three candidates for state office stood with him there to show support as well. Each of them had a chance to speak briefly about their own candidacy and platform. Their comments there were not exclusively about the bridges, but Deaton did focus primarily on bridge funding in much of his remarks.
And what did he have to say about the project to replace the Bourne and Sagamore bridges?
Well, he said that he believes Senator Warren hasn't done enough to advocate for funding for the bridges. He accused her of not working with former Governor Charlie Baker on that project when Baker was in office because of partisanship, Deaton said. He also said Warren is too much of a national political figure who travels around the country. He accused her of being absent from Massachusetts. Now, of course, I asked Warren's campaign for a comment on all of that. A spokesperson for the campaign said that Warren has helped to bring to Massachusetts the federal funding that has been dedicated to the Cape Cod bridges so far, which is $722 million. In addition to that, Warren and the rest of the delegation signed a letter in March addressed to Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. And there they were urging the administration to approve a big grant that's coming up, that more than $1 billion grant that we've talked about before that could come for the bridges. But of course, it's not certain. It's a yes or no on the grant. And that's under consideration now. If the state does get that grant, then the combined public funding from the state and federal governments is just about the amount of the first bridge, the estimated cost right now for the first bridge, which is the Sagamore.
This is such a big project that we're told that the estimate for replacing both the Sagamore and the Bourne Bridge is about $4.5 billion. It's a mix of money coming from state, but largely from federal end of this. We know that the state was denied bridge funding twice under the Baker administration. What do we know about what's changed to make the funding start coming together under the current state administration?
The planning for the bridge project is farther along now, and the state has committed hundreds of millions of dollars to the project. Both of those things generally create a stronger application for a grant, and that's what some of the observers have been saying. Also, the Healey administration decided to split the Bourne and Sagamore bridges into two projects for these funding purposes. And of course, the cost of each one separately is about half the cost of the two combined. And when they are combined, the estimate is $4.5 billion, which makes them one of the most expensive infrastructure projects happening right now in the country. Of course, the more expensive the project, the bigger the bite it takes out of any pool of public money that's being awarded. So perhaps splitting the projects could make them more fundable in that way.
Who were the other candidates there with Deaton this afternoon? And briefly, what was their message?
The other candidates there were three Republicans: Christopher Lauzon, who is running for state senate in the Cape and Islands district; Carrie McRae, who is a state senate candidate in the Plymouth and Barnstable district; and the third was Suzanne Conley from Barnstable. She is a Massachusetts House candidate, excuse me, in the second Barnstable district. Generally, with regard to the bridges, they were saying that not enough has been done by people who are in office now to get the bridges built sooner rather than later. They certainly have other issues that they are running on as well, but this event really was focused mainly on the bridges.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Every summer, dozens of volunteers work with the Buzzards Bay Coalition, contributing data to one of the longest-running water quality programs in the region. But CAI's Eve Zuckoff reports that work could start to change in that project. And Eve is joining us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Walk us through how water quality data has been collected for this Buzzards Bay Coalition up to this point.
Sure. So I'll walk you through it from the perspective of two of the volunteers who I spent some time with. They're these two women, two neighbors who go to Buzzards Bay every 10 days with a carload full of gear. And they spend an hour and a half in the morning measuring things like dissolved oxygen, water temperature, salinity, air temperature. And they're trained to work with all this gear. People may remember some of this from chemistry class in school, like a Secchi disc and reagent packets and dozens of other kind of doodads that I was admiring while I was with them. And they fill out a worksheet and send it to Buzzards Bay Coalition. Meanwhile, dozens of other volunteers are doing the same thing at other sites around the bay. And the combination of all of this data creates a sense of what water quality is like in the bay and creates this really long-term data set.
So you just described a very hands-on process
yes,
that would
very.
Happen every 5 days to figure out what the water quality is like in the bay. Now there's some new technology on the scene. Tell us about this and how it works.
Right. So the coalition is now experimenting with data loggers. So again, we'll go visual here. I want you to imagine a milk crate, a literal milk crate. Scientists have strapped onto it a little computer that looks like a glasses case to the top, and they've weighed down this contraption so it sits on the seafloor. And this computer that they can haul up whenever they want with a rope is collecting data every 10 minutes. Thank you. I'm sorry. I said 10 days before I meant it here. Every 10 minutes. And these data loggers are still pretty new, but they've already begun to show that there is pretty dangerously low oxygen levels that are happening in the bay that are going undetected as much as 40% of the time because there are just these natural gaps between when these volunteers can get out and collect data.
Bring this together. How is this all important for us?
Yeah, well, all of this is measuring. All of this data is measuring how much pollution is actually going on. Because the reason that Buzzards Bay is having these low oxygen events is that our septic systems and our fertilizers in our backyard are putting all of this nitrogen that's making its way into the water body and creating all these water quality problems for us. So better data with less human error means that the Buzzards Bay Coalition can work with communities and say, hey, here's a real snapshot of our water. And they can talk to state environment officials to push for better policy to protect the bay. Like, for example, they could push policy that limits major nearby developments that rely on septic systems or policy that phases in nitrogen-reducing septic systems for homeowners. There's kind of a suite of options once you have a clear picture.
So that's the environmental side. There's also this very human side to this story. This program, as you say, has been going for about 3 decades. Mm. Volunteers have been going out there every 5 days to check the water quality in all these different places around the bay. Are these volunteers who have given so much time to this project, are they going to be replaced by technology?
Well, for now, the Buzzards Bay Coalition, you know, they're just spending the summer testing data loggers at 19 of the 200 volunteer stations around the bay. But yeah, the technology could bring a not so welcome change for this community of volunteers who really love this work. It really means something to them. But the coalition assures me that the human touch will be necessary to collect some kinds of data for the foreseeable future. So even as researchers are relying more heavily on the technology, they say there is no world that they can imagine without volunteers.
Okay, Eve, before we let you go, I want to talk about something else that you've been working on. Our National Weather Service is forecasting an extraordinarily busy hurricane season. With 17 to 25 named storms predicted, you've been looking at what this might mean for the Cape and Islands and South Coast.
Yes, so for the next three Thursdays, we're going to be having conversations on Morning Edition where we kind of are playing out a worst-case scenario summer and what that might look like here on the Cape. So Hurricane Beryl just destroyed, brutalized, honestly, communities from the Caribbean to Texas when it became the earliest Category 5 hurricane on record. And we wanted to pull apart the pieces of what would happen if or when, frankly, a storm like that makes its way to this region. That last happened 33 years ago in Hurricane Bob, so many of us don't remember what it might look like on the Cape to get a Category 3 major hurricane. So we're going to be looking at the science behind what it would take for a storm like this to come this way, how it would test our infrastructure, our bridges, our emergency planners, what it could do to our real estate market and economy. So I've been absorbing a ton of information, talking to a lot of experts over the last couple of weeks, and learning a lot even after 5 years of covering climate change in the region. So I hope folks will get a chance to listen for the next three Thursdays on Morning Edition when we bring these conversations.
That is CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Drunker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The need for workforce housing on Martha's Vineyard is not disputed, but some construction underway right now is raising questions about where it belongs and how it should be viewed. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this, and he joins us in studio. Sam, great to see you.
Great to be here.
The story here focuses on workforce housing specifically being developed for what would be employees of Vineyard Wind, the offshore wind company. And one house in particular in Tisbury has become kind of a flashpoint for this.
Yeah, right. There's this one developer in town who's developing a number of properties, but this one on Spring Street, not far from our own newsroom, not far from where Vineyard Wind is setting up their O&M operation maintenance building, has tried to develop what looks like a nine-bedroom, nine-bathroom housing development. And what has really irked residents in the area is that it didn't get what they think is the proper review. Essentially, the building inspector approved this as a single-family home, which requires just a simple building permit, and the pushback being, if this is a workforce housing development, which it appears to be with nine bedrooms, nine bathrooms, should have gone through a much more rigorous vetting process. And it didn't. And there's been a lot of pushback from residents, from the town's planning board, to push this through to a higher level of review.
And it's in a neighborhood on a street of single family homes.
Right. And I think that's the rub. When you think of the housing crisis on the island, there's no doubt. Some might doubt it, but there is a large shortage of housing. So where do you put that housing when there's all these single family residents around the island? And in Tisbury in particular, the residents are saying, I've lived here for a long time. It's a nice, quaint community. And here you have an offshore wind developer coming in, wanting to build these larger developments. Some are saying are going to be recruiting folks from off-island to work, aren't technically islanders. So you're taking housing away from what could be an island family and giving it to, turn it into a building that's kind of a large structure in kind of a quaint neighborhood. And they're saying this deserves more review. We don't like this.
Yeah. So the town obviously has planning people who are supposed to be watching this, signing off on permits. What's the town say around this?
Yeah. So our publisher has been very, for us, saying we need to get comment from folks, whether that means going and knocking on their door. which we have done multiple times in this circumstance. We called, we emailed, trying to get a response why the building inspector did do this, and he did not respond. And I think, you know, I think this is an interesting story. I think there might be some sympathy for what happened with the need for all of this housing. Why is there such a big outcry when someone's actually doing it, building workforce housing? We wanted to get his opinion on why it did. We didn't hear it. However, we did hear from the planning board, and I think this is where the story is going. The planning board is really upset that this didn't get the proper review. So they stepped in and said, all right, we're going to look at this. We're actually going to send it to the Martha's Vineyard Commission, which is a big regional body where projects really slow down, if I could editorialize. And I think they, in their remarks, they also really, you know, threw out the building inspector with a kind of a harsh criticism, saying, why, you know, you're not giving this the proper vetting that it deserves. We'll see. I mean, I think this will ultimately go to the Martha's Vineyard Commission. Construction has stopped on the building. We'll see what happens.
Another part of this whole story is the fact that this developer, one developer, is really working with Vineyard Wind to create a lot of housing for Vineyard Wind employees. Part of Vineyard Wind's promise when it came aboard was that it was going to, you know, be an economic boost for the community,
right?
A year-round economic boost. So,
right.
So here is the deliverable on that, and it's kind of running into a number of challenges on where to build these housing for people, right?
Right, right. And we have documented this one developer, at least 24 units of housing that he's looking at, but there are several more, I believe, that he's involved in. There are other developers, too, who are trying to build workforce housing that have actually, partly through residents complaining, I'd partly say, maybe speaking too highly of ourselves, but partly through our reporting, the planning board has started to look at other projects that are also kind of skirted through without their review, and they're raising their interest, and they are taking them up and passing them on. And I think one point we should say, and this is, it's kind of created an interesting discussion. If we do need workforce housing, which I think a lot of people argue we do, where do you put it?
And what does it look like? Yeah.
And what does it look like? Yeah. And I think the residents would say, well, not in my backyard. But I think the planning board is saying we need to have that discussion. What does it look like? And where are we going to put it?
Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times, where you can read all about it. Sam, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Sticking with housing, Chatham is moving ahead with a major housing development. The town manager has selected a project developer, which also defines the project. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with details. Hiya, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, not everybody involved here is pleased with the direction that this will now be going, but start by explaining the decision that was made here to go with this one developer.
Sure. The developer, Penrose, was chosen by town manager Jill Goldsmith, who's the town's procurement officer and has the final decision over matters like this, to develop affordable and workforce housing at the former Buckley property on Main Street and a Meeting House Road parcel that the town purchased a few years back. Their plan is to build 48 rental units at the Main Street property and 42 at the Meeting House Road property. This Penrose was recommended by a evaluation committee, which looked at three different proposals that were submitted for these properties, and chosen by that evaluation committee, which included the entire select board and the entire Affordable Housing Trust. And as you said, Steve, that recommendation from that evaluation committee was not unanimous.
So this proposal is for 90 units altogether, right? And that's a lot of housing they're looking to create. But these are all going to be rental units, and that's part of why people were concerned.
That's exactly right. All of these units will be rentals, the dissenters on both the select board and the Affordable Housing Committee favored Penrose for developing the Meeting House Road property. But they believed that the Housing Assistance Corporation, which submitted a proposal for home ownership units on the Main Street property, they believed that that was a better plan for the needs of the town. They felt that home ownership is something that the town should be encouraging, and that it would serve more the workforce side of the housing needs than the sort of affordable with a capital A side. So those four folks felt that Housing Assistance Corporation should be the one to develop the Main Street property.
This dissent, as you say, these projects were looked at very closely by the boards, and a decision has been made. But folks are not walking away from this easily, it sounds like.
Yeah, there was a controversy over this because the four dissenters wrote a letter to the editor published in the Chronicle, basically putting forth their case for HAC to develop the Main Street property, and it turned out that this rubbed some members of the Affordable Housing Trust the wrong way. At a meeting a couple weeks ago, member David Oppenheim suggested that those members of the housing trust who didn't back the vote of the board should consider resigning, and there was a controversy over that. Those two folks, Carolyn McLennan and Bruce Bean, both said that they're not going to resign, and they felt that they had a right to express their opinion through that letter to the editor, and they again felt strongly that home ownership proposals should be part of this whole mix of affordable and workforce housing for Chatham.
Can you describe for the project that has been chosen, which is rentals, as we said, what was the thinking behind that? And because the town manager has expressed why she felt like this is the best project to go forward with right now.
Yeah, she felt that the project was would really fit in with what Chatham needs right now, and that there are very few rental units in Chatham for any income level, really, and when those and their availability is few and far between. So she felt that rental units would fit the needs that the town is looking at right now. She also felt that, renters are just as valuable to the community as home ownership folks. And she also noted that Penrose, as a private developer, is not going to be seeking any municipal funding for this development. They will be seeking the town to underwrite a sort of mortgage for this, but that's in the $700,000 range, while HAC's proposal was looking for $5.4 million in town support for their home ownership project. So that was a key decision point for Joe Goldsmith, I think, because the town's been having some issues with big budget items getting through town meeting. So I think she felt that this was not necessarily a less advantageous proposal, but one that was more realistic to get built.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Kamala Harris is coming to Provincetown for a fundraiser next week. It's got a lot of people talking. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent has his ear to the ground and joins us. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
It hardly seems necessary to explain, but after the presidential debate, it remains something of an open question if Joe Biden will lead the Democratic ticket. So the current vice president coming to Provincetown, a lot of people see Kamala as one obvious alternative. I guess start by telling us about this event, what it looks like for Provincetown.
Okay, well, it's happening on July 20th, and it's been planned for quite a while by the Biden Victory Fund. At this point, it's really developed into a major Democratic Party event. You know, Provincetown has always been very friendly territory for the Democrats, and especially for the support of the LGBTQ community. This time, not just Vice President Harris is coming, but she will be joined by Governor Maura Healey, Senator Ed Markey, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg and his husband, Chasten Buttigieg, and even Delaware State Senator Sarah McBride, who is running for Congress and, if elected, would be the first transgender person in Congress.
And this is a fundraiser with a big price tag attached to it.
Yes, the tickets ranged from $50, which there weren't many of and disappeared very quickly, to $25,000 for a co-host, $50,000 for host, and $150,000 to be chair, of which there are a number. As of early this week, the event had already raised $1.3 million. I'm sure it will end up being quite a bit more than that. As you mentioned, there's a lot of angst and panic.
I want to point to this because this is really what makes this news, is that this is an opportunity for some big dollar donors to really express some doubts that they have about what the ticket is doing now for the Democrats.
Yeah, well, the official hosts and chairs of the event are all saying, they have no doubt. Brian Raffanelli, for example, who's one of the chairs, says his confidence in Biden is not at all shaken. I'm 150% behind the president, he said. But others who are not so closely identified with the fundraising event have expressed much more striking doubts, including Terrence Meck, who's a prominent Provincetown funder of liberal causes. He's president of the Palette Fund. He told our reporter, Cam Kettles, that he had pledged $25,000 to be a co-host, but withdrew about a week after the debate. He said the best thing that the president could do for our country and to protect democracy is to step down and pass the baton on to the next generation, which is something he promised when he ran in 2020. And Dan Wolf, who everyone knows out here as former state senator and founder of Cape Air, went so far as to tell us that he thought that Biden should resign and allow Kamala Harris to run as the incumbent president. It would be a really magnificent gesture, Wolf said.
I want to jump in here because we have just about a minute, but I want to point to the fact that this is a fast-moving story. So she's Kamala Harris is coming to Provincetown July 20th. Between now and then, this story could be moving. She could show up here, and a lot of people could be looking at her in a different way than she is right now.
I think people already are looking at her in a different way. And, the front page of today's New York Times says that Biden's isolation deepens as doubters' ranks grow. And a lot of people, I think, are thinking that Biden, in fact, is not going to be the candidate and that Kamala Harris is one of the top contenders, not necessarily a shoo-in. But I think people are going to be watching her very closely, thinking, is this someone who could beat Donald Trump? And that is the bottom line. Everyone that we spoke to, who on the record and off the record, said the number one goal is to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. And what's the best possible way to do that?
It's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we will hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Nantucket has been planning to build a town-owned nursing facility to replace the one it has, a new one. This week, the cost estimate came out for that, and it was about twice the number that had been initially discussed, more than $100 million. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
This plan still has to be approved by voters, and the plan is still being shaped, right?
Yeah, well, the design is in now. The price tag is in, which we reported yesterday, at which you said a huge number. But the funding for this still has to go before voters. town meeting already endorsed $8 million for the design and planning of this effort. This is a project that's been discussed for over a decade, replacing the existing nursing home facility that, as you mentioned, is a municipally run facility. Nantucket is the only municipality in Massachusetts that has a public or town run nursing home. And again, this is, you know, something that is another unique thing about Nantucket, but something that has been a priority for the town and its residents to be able to take care of our elders and people in need and not have to have them and their families go off island for that kind of skilled nursing care. So it's been something that the town has funded through overrides in the past, something that voters have prioritized and been generous with. Now it's the redesign of this facility and the relocation of it is going to be another big ticket item for voters to consider here, probably at next year's annual town meeting.
We will be watching that. I want to ask you about another story out this week. The island's bus service is free this summer, and the result has been a really significant uptick in ridership. And it sounds like while an increase in riders was expected, this has been kind of a surprise, just how big an increase they've seen.
Yeah, exactly. The Nantucket Regional Transit Authority, or NRTA, which runs the WAVE buses that, you know, go all around town, all around the island, did get a state grant that allowed them to make the bus service free for the public for the entire summer. And again, this was expected that, you know, you make it free and you build it, people will come, and it'll make it easier for people to get on and get off and not have to worry about figuring out the fares. So they expected a increase in ridership. What they've seen is beyond their expectations. Ridership up 80% since this free fare was initiated. And so they're hoping that this is alleviating some traffic that otherwise would have resulted in, you know, people driving cars on the road or taxis and Ubers, and that it's a sort of pilot to hopefully make this a permanent thing for the island to have the free buses. But right now it goes through September. And they're expecting the ridership to be, you know, through the roof here, given the free fares that NRTA has implemented for the summer. So a good thing for transit on the island and for people taking advantage of the service.
The number they're saying is 100,000 passengers in July alone?
That's what they're projecting here for this month.
And you think about what that means in terms of traffic that's not on the roads.
Exactly. So that's a huge benefit given what we've seen this summer, which has been, you know, gridlock, despite the fact that we've been taking that many people and put them on public transit. And that's actually a problem that the service is running into, is to have timely routes and getting people to where they, you know, they need to be on time is the gridlock of the island and getting these buses through traffic. But overall, this is a good story for NRTA, for the island, that this making it fare free has really resonated with the public.
It's Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
With some Democrats urging President Biden not to run again, some tension has even developed between Biden and Governor Healey. Also, junk fees could be on their way out for good in Massachusetts. Our Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke to our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about these stories and more. Here's their conversation.
Hello there, Katie.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning. More Democrats in Massachusetts and beyond are calling on the president to bail out of the election, which is 3.5 months away now. Where's Governor Healey on this? And didn't President Biden himself call her out regarding her stance on this?
Yeah, so Healey, over the holiday, the New York Times reported last week that she had described the president's electoral position as irretrievable after that rocky debate. And after the fact, Healey called for him to listen carefully to the American people and evaluate what comes next for his reelection campaign. Now, reportedly, when the president was asked about that, he pointed out that she stayed quiet in a meeting between Democratic governors and the president. Since then, Healey has said just this week that she believes Biden could beat Trump, but that it's his decision to make whether he stays in the race. She would not elaborate when asked this week what she meant by irretrievable or how Biden seemed in that private meeting with the governors.
Huge moment right now for American politics. Let's talk about state politics, though. Massachusetts House Democrats now pushing to prohibit cell phone carriers and data providers from collecting or selling location information on people at reproductive health clinics. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a response to movements in other states, political movements that are aiming to really restrict reproductive health or gender-affirming care. The Democrats in the Massachusetts House, and actually this passed with Republican support as well, want to protect your cell phone location data. If you're visiting somewhere to receive reproductive or gender-affirming care, a clinic, by preventing that data from being sold to third parties, they worry about what other entities could do if they had that information and breach people's privacy in that way.
Also, Katie, the state Senate is taking up its version of the big economic development bill. Lawmakers want to use it as a way to pass consumer protections for event ticket sales. So I'm assuming this would address those hidden fees we don't find out about until we're already buying a ticket to a concert.
Absolutely. One of the big pieces that both the House and the Senate are pursuing on ticketing is a requirement that the full ticket price be disclosed before the very last stage of your checkout. Everyone who's bought a ticket has seen those numbers balloon as you keep going through the process. And then there's other things that the two branches are looking at, like guaranteeing refunds and event cancellations and other situations. So there are some specific differences between the two proposals. So that is one of the many, many policy matters that the House and Senate will need to work through and come to some sort of agreement on if they want to get a bill to the governor by this upcoming July 31st deadline.
Katie, by the way, are these akin to junk fees we often hear President Biden talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And you know who else talks about that a lot is State Attorney General Andrea Campbell. This has been a big issue from her because she also has a consumer protection mandate in her office.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's do away with the junk fees. Finally, the state's marijuana regulator is known as the Cannabis Control Commission. You've done great reporting on this, and I want to be clear on this because we share this with our audience every day. It's a mess right now. No one's leading the Cannabis Control Commission at this moment. Things are so bad there that there are now calls for appointing a receiver to run the commission. What on earth is a receiver, Katie?
It is a classic bit of state government jargon. The Cannabis Control Commission, as you say, is currently without a permanent executive director or a permanent chair. So the state's inspector general has flagged some concerns there about what he calls a leadership crisis that he believes has roots in the law that set up the commission. So he wants to have state government appoint someone new to come in and lead a turnaround plan to get the commission to steady the ship, he says. Of course, the current commissioners disagree that that's needed. They think they've got the situation under control internally. So that's really what a receiver is. It's something you see a lot in school districts or kind of municipal entities. It'd be very rare to have that kind of outside third party turnaround leader appointed at a state agency. One state lawmaker this week said it's a nuclear option. It's so unusual.
Katie, as always, we appreciate your insight from the State House. Folks, that is Katie Lannon, our State House correspondent here on CAI. Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Morning Edition's Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Carlos Rafael, the fishing magnate known as the Cod Father, went to prison for fraud and tax evasion. Now he's out and he's directing his considerable financial resources into real estate in and around New Bedford. Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light has the story and joins us. Hi, Will.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Will, your reporting here is extremely vivid. It sounds like you sat down in the office with Rafael and he spoke to you quite candidly.
Yeah, I did. Carlos Rafael is someone who, you know, really needs no introduction in New Bedford. Sat down with him in his office. It's this kind of industrial warehouse in the south end of New Bedford, and asked him about his most recent business endeavors after being banned from the fishing industry. How exactly is he parlaying his $100 million in profit he got from being forced to sell his fleet?
So $100 million, people may be surprised to hear how much money he made from the sale of his fleet and his fishing quota, even after he'd been convicted of essentially manipulating fishing markets and spent almost 4 years in prison for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really substantial amount of money. It's, you know, it's so much money, it doesn't make sense just to, you know, hold it in a bank account. what the story really is about Carlos becoming a bank in some way. He, in 2020, after he was, when he was just serving out his final few months on his four-year prison sentence, he, along with his family, bought the Merchants National Bank, the building in downtown New Bedford. It's a very prominent historic building, you know, right in the center of the city. The bank doesn't actually function as a commercial bank anymore, but it's become the kind of seed investment of what has turned into this multi-million dollar real estate financing operation that, you know, spans across the whole New Bedford area.
Tell us about the kinds of properties that he's investing in, and how does that generally work? He's loaning money essentially to developers, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's there's a few terms for it. Private lending is one, as he called it, kind of, you know, jokingly or loosely. Loan sharking is another. It is all legal. I want to be, you know, very clear about that. But it's private lending. So it's, you know, private loans to developers who are hoping to flip, redevelop and flip houses in New Bedford. In New Bedford, there are kind of this complicated economic equation around housing. You know, for one, there's, you know, rent in New Bedford is extremely low in comparison to Boston or, you know, other parts of the state. So a lot of people are moving down here to New Bedford. There's an incredible demand for housing. However, because rents are so low, there's not much return for investors who are hoping to buy or renovate or build houses in the area. So it's very hard to secure financing. And on top of that, there's, you know, some 570 houses that are vacant because of this economic equation. I spoke to some of these developers who Carlos Rafael is financing, and they told me pretty clearly this is, you know, the only way we're going to be able to, you know, turn some of these vacant houses into places that are livable for families in New Bedford is through this kind of private loans.
So he's making short-term private loans at fairly significant interest rates, because he explained all this to you.
Yeah. He explained it to me very clearly. It's short-term loans. The interest rate is 14%, which is, you know, somewhat higher than a 30-year, you know, average mortgage currently. But it is only a 6-month loan, so it's it is pretty standard when it comes to, you know, this kind of private lending. These numbers here. He was very candid about it when I sat down with him. He was actually, you know, somewhat excited to talk about it. I think he's been, you know, missing the business world ever since being banned from fishing.
So he is banned from fishing. This is a new enterprise for him. On one aspect of this, it sounds like something that the city needs, and he's kind of providing a service that is helping the city that way and helping to turn these vacant properties into housing. But when you, in your conversation, as you describe it, he's not doing this from a lot of civic feeling. In fact, he almost expresses the opposite of that.
Yeah, Carlos is a man with an incredibly complicated legacy. For some people, he's seen as sort of an anti-hero or a Robin Hood, you know, someone who stuck it to the government and, built this massive fishing empire even while the government was trying to, you know, take him down. And for some, he's seen as a crook and, a fraudster and someone who, you know, expanded at the expense of fraud and hurting the environment and overfishing, which is, you know, essentially what he went to jail for eventually. He was a ruthless businessman, and a lot of people, you know, came at the butt end of that. This real estate financing operation, essentially turning vacant homes being flipped into houses, it is a good deed. However, when I asked him about it, his motives, they were, is there any altruism in it? He kind of chuckled, and, you know, this is about making money is what he said.
It's a great interview. You can read it on the website of the New Bedford Light. That's Will Sennett. Will, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
That's the news for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent, Jason Grazzi, Dave of Nantucket Current, CAI's Patrick Flannery with State House reporter Katie Lannon, Will Sennett of the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.